Hello friends, and welcome back to yet another episode of What Page Are You On? It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
It you, Alice Slater. I've missed you. I feel like we haven't recorded for a little while
together. It feels like it's been years.
It does feel like it's been years. We are not alone today, are we?
Certainly not.
We are joined by it you, Jen Campbell.
It me, hi. Hello, hi. Thank you for having me.
Hello, thank you so much for joining us. So Jen is the author of several books, including The Sister Who Ate Her Brothers and Other Gruesome Tales, which is out now. And yeah, I think we were originally planning to squeeze you into spooky season, but spooky season is just over as soon as it begins. And I guess if you're truly spooky at heart, every season is spooky season. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
For delaying spooky education.
I was going to say, spooky books aren't just for Halloween. They are for all year round, you know?
It's true.
It can be our Christmas, so yeah. All year.
Yep, so true. Girl after my own heart.
Well, we're very happy to have you. Alice, would you like to begin?
Well, okay, so I just wanted to kick off by asking you, like, what's the story behind The Sister Who Ate Her Brothers? Like, what's the story behind the book itself?
Oh, okay, the story behind the book itself. I have wanted to do a collection of fairy tale. I hesitate to call them retellings. They are retellings, but often I think when we think of retellings, we think of, you know, transporting them into the modern day or whatever. So these are old fairy tales that I have researched and unearthed. Some of them are more well known than others, and I have written them again in my own words, so that is a rewriting, and I have changed certain elements to keep the traditional gory feel of them, because they are gruesome. As you so beautifully said, I would actually like you, Bethany, to just come around with me to say that title and roll that R. I think that was fantastic. I loved it. Thank you. Because they are really gruesome. But then updating it in the sense that I've included queer representation, which is really hard to find in old fairy tales, and also positive representation of disability and disfigurement.
We're going to come to that. That's going to be something that I definitely want to talk to you about.
Fabulous. And for the past, oh, I don't know, several years, excluding the last two because those don't count, I've spent a lot of time going into schools and teaching the history of fairy tales to kids, and linking that in with poetry and storytelling. And just, I delight so much in telling kids the true history of fairy tales and how disgusting it is, because their faces just light up. So this really convinced me that, yes, this is something I want to do. It's particularly for middle grades at 8 to 12, but for adults as well, you know, anyone who enjoys a gory tale or two. So yeah, That's kind of the story. I wanted to terrify children and adults. There we go. that's the hook.
Kids absolutely love morbid stories. They go mad for them.
Oh, yeah. Like, if I mention fairy tales in a classroom, at first they're like, oh, Disney. Like, oh, no. I mean, some people are like, oh, yay, Disney. But, you know, a lot of them are like, ugh. Princesses, disgusting. And I'm like, no, let me talk to you about Cinderella. Did you know in an old version the sisters cut off their toes and their heels and like nearly bled to death in order to try and win the prince's heart? And then when they got found out, doves pecked out their eyes, and they're like, oh my god, tell us more about that. And I'm like, yes, absolutely, I will. And then we do fairy tale retellings, and they come up with the best ones. My favorite was a boy in year six, so he was about 11, who wrote a retelling of Rapunzel, where Rapunzel was a drag queen and wore fabulous wigs. And if she didn't like the prince that was climbing up her wig to the tower, she'd just take her wig off and drop it to the ground and watch him die. I'm like, this is great. I love it.
That mind.
I know. Terrifying and brilliant at the same time.
So obviously there is, you know, a rich seam of fairy tales and these kind of folk stories that you could draw from. But what was your, was there kind of like a guiding thing of like stories that you definitely wanted to include? Was that like a theme or like things that you're particularly interested in, stories that add a certain element or ingredient?
Well, for this one, I obviously was drawn to the particularly scary ones, and that's such a, as you say, like a huge pool to gather from anyway, so it doesn't narrow it too much. So there were lots of different considerations when collecting them. Obviously, I hope maybe I could do more in the future. We're talking about different fairy tale books that I could do, which maybe we can talk about later. But for this particular one, I wanted a good geographical range, so they are from all the way around the world. I can list the countries here. So we've got Korea, Ireland, Japan, Norway, Nigeria, an Inuit fairy tale. We've got one from Egypt, Germany, Russia, El Salvador, South Africa, India, China, and Spain. So it was to try and get a wide range of stories, try and find ones that were lesser known, and then also balance it out, because I couldn't just have all terrifying stories back to back, because I mean, maybe you could, but that's a little bit much. So you want the waves in a story collection, which is something that I've thought about before when writing short story collections and poetry collections for adults. You know, how do you order them? You have to have a mix, some shorter, some longer. Couldn't have all the stories featuring cannibalism, unfortunately. You know, I do love children. I know, I do love children being baked into pies, but I had to pick my favourites. And at the beginning, when I was researching, the history of fairy tales is like my pet subject. I've been researching it for years, but this was like obviously a proper deep dive to try and unearth stories. And I had hoped at the beginning that I was going to come across some old fairy tales that already had really good representation. And the further I got into it, the more I realized, I'm not sure that I'm going to find them. So I did have to do more retelling in that respect than I had hoped I would. And this is not to say that those fairy tales do not exist. They absolutely do. I mean, the thing with fairy tales is that obviously they were told orally. Anyone could tell them. You didn't have to be able to read and write to write them down and collect them. But then when they were written down and collected, it was mainly, you know, straight men who were writing them down, and they didn't care about a lot of stuff that they picked the stuff that they cared about, and then they included that. So a lot of queer stories have been lost. And obviously fairy tales are very old ones, very into moral tales and using bodily differences as some kind of moral, which we have now thankfully moved away from, though we could move away from it even more, and I would quite enjoy that. So it's not surprising that I couldn't find, you know, it that many. So that was something that I'd hoped to discover and hadn't discovered as much. But I did find the Irish tale in here, which is a queer fairy tale, was a queer fairy tale.
Oh,
cool. And even though, spoiler, like one of them dies at the end, and obviously that is a massive trope, sure. You know, the gay one dies at the end, and something that I would like to also, because it was a queer fairy tale that I found, I'm like, but I really need to include this one. I will include a happy queer story too, so that we don't have just this. But it's a tale that involves mermaids, and mermaids are really important in queer culture, and I mean that like in a wide sense, you know, like bodily transformation. It's stories that queer people have always been drawn to. It was argued that Hans Christian Andersen wrote The Little Mermaid because he was in love with his friend Edward Collins, and it was a metaphor for that. So that was what I wanted to include, even though it didn't have a happy ending. But to be fair, not many of these stories do have happy endings, so that's fine.
So I'd love to like drill a little bit more into things that you decided to change. In what other ways did you change these stories to suit your, you know, contemporary audience?
Well, some of them were just artistic changes, so things that I wanted to change just to put my own spin on them. So in the Nigerian fairy tale, which is the daughter that loved a skeleton, I made the skeleton's mother a house, and she's not in the original tale, she's just a person, but I wanted to change that and make it into something bigger. So in the fairy tale, this particular fairy tale, a young woman makes a drawing of a man that she wants to marry, and she says, I won't marry anyone apart from this person right here, I only care about looks. So no one comes and answers her drawing because no one looks the way that she has drawn them. But then the skeleton sees the drawing and thinks, oh, I can manage that. So he goes to a graveyard and just picks out all the relevant different body parts from different people and makes himself into this beautiful human and wanders into the world of the living and says, you have to come meet my mother, though. So he drags her into the world of the dead, and the mother in this case is a house. And if she doesn't like her, she'll eat her. So that was a choice. I mean, I just say, so not all of them are, you know, wanting to include representation. They're just stylistic choices, which, yeah, I think is what's really exciting about fairy tales, you know, because they don't belong to a specific person. They've always been chopped and changed, and they adhere to the agenda of whoever is doing the telling. And I fully admit I have a queer disabled agenda, like put it on a t-shirt, I have that, and that's fine. So I think they're really fun for that. And I think especially when it comes to disability and queerness, it's why it's so fun to subvert them, because when you subvert fairy tales, you're not just presenting a new version of a tale that's interesting, you're asking the reader to examine why perhaps they've never seen that in a fairy tale before.
You clearly have done, you know, a ton of research in this area, and especially for this book, looking in a really kind of global perspective. So would you say that there is like a particular kind of country or like geographical area that you feel has like a ton of really banging fairy tales, either that is well known or that you have discovered through your research?
Something that I knew already before going in from previous research, and probably comes as no surprise to anyone, is that the Nordic countries and the Arctic countries in particular, they have the best dark fairy tales because they have literally the most darkness. So they had more time that they needed to fill with stories, and the dark fairy tales definitely linger there. I'm just looking at my fairy tale shelf. I was gonna pull out, oh yeah, can I just grab this? I want to tell you one of that I couldn't include in the book because this is not for children. It's not for children at all. Let me now not be able to, I'm probably not going to be able to find it. Give me a second. Oh, you know what, I think I'm gonna give up, and I'm gonna paraphrase for you. So I'm going to spare you me looking through the entire book and just say that if you would like, I love how I'm here, like, supposed to be promoting my own book. I'm just going to recommend somebody else's. If you would like more adult versions of fairy tales as well, Angela Carter's book of fairy tales is obviously, like, from around the world, is amazing. And there's one of those which I can't remember if it's an Inuit or an Icelandic fairy tale, but it's about a girl who tricks her mother-in-law, and then the mother-in-law tricks her back and makes her eat something which makes scorpions just endlessly pour out of her vagina. And I was like, wait, what? And it's a really short tale. She makes her, I think the daughter makes the mother-in-law drink her own urine, and then the mother-in-law gets her revenge by making scorpions flow out of her daughter-in-law's vagina. And I was like, oh, well, I won't include that in my book, but, you know, good, that's nice. Thanks.
So, truly, I don't know what I was expecting, but yeah. I don't think probably not that prepared me for that.
I mean, my God. There is a story in The Sister Who Ate Her Brothers, which is from India, and it's called The Son of Seven Mothers. And at the end of that, the bad person is punished by scorpions appearing out of her body and out of her mouth, like out of her mouth, I should repeat, out of her mouth. But whenever I look back on that story now, I think of the other one and I'm like, it could be worse, you know. I mean, the scorpions are coming out of your mouth, it definitely could be worse. Be grateful.
So okay, this actually interests me. I think this is a question that I was going to ask a bit later on, but I'm going to ask it now. So yep. We have two stories there from different places, both of which involve scorpions coming out of body parts, orifices, yeah, out of oneself. How come there are so many kind of similarities, tropes, matching symbolism in fairy tales from all around the world?
Oh, it's such a fascinating thing. And I think what's really interesting about it is that there are never going to be, well, very rarely are there going to be definitive answers as to why. We can speculate and we can think about trade routes, for instance, in, you know, hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, and how tales might have traveled to different parts of the world, because there are certain fairy tales that you would assume were inspired by each other, but there are cases where that is just absolutely impossible. And it amuses me that some folklorists really argue over you know, trying to prove how tales are connected. We can prove how tales are not connected by saying, look, you know, trade routes weren't open between these places at that time, so it's impossible. Doing the proving of how things are connected is harder. But there is a database called the Arne Thompson Uther Index, where folklorists have catalogued hundreds of fairy tales, and they've given them numbers. So this is, I don't think this is the correct number, it may be, I don't remember, but Snow White is 291 or something, and that will catalogue like a woman eating something and falling asleep.
What appears in The Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado? Is that, you know, when there's like a kind of catalogue like tropes in fairy tales, is that the same resource?
I would imagine so. It's been a while since I've read that. I read that book last year. I think so. I think she does include those. It's a really fascinating thing to look at. I don't think that we can use it as absolute fact, but it's just a fun thing to play around with and notice similarities. But for instance, there are two really old versions of what we now know as Cinderella that cannot be inspired by each other because trade links between Europe and China weren't open. So the oldest form of Cinderella that we know is called Rhodopis. And this was like hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago. It was, I think, first recorded in 400 BC was talked about then, and then it was written down, and it was supposed to be inspired by a real life person called Rhodopis, who was from Greece, and who was sold into slavery in Germany. That is incorrect. Sold into slavery in Egypt. Okay, Egypt. And then the rumor is that she was bathing by the River Nile, and she took off one of her golden slippers, and a falcon came down and stole it. And flew around with it and then dropped it. And a pharaoh found it and thought, I quite like this. I would quite like to marry whoever owns this shoe. So he then looked everywhere for the person who owned the shoe and then ended up marrying Rhodopis. But then there is also a Chinese version of Cinderella, which is called Ye Shen, which is hundreds of years after that. But as I said, the trade links weren't open. And it's about a young woman called Ye Shen who lives in a cave with her stepmother and half-sister. And they hate her and they're horrible to her, which is actually one of the rarer occurrences of a stepmother being horrible in old tales. Normally it was the mother, and then it was changed later, primarily because of the Grimms, to be stepmothers, to kind of create a distance and become more Christian. But in this version, it was her stepmother who was horrible to her. And so she wanted to escape, and she wanted to go to, not a ball, but it was a local market fair. But she had no clothes to dress up in. But instead of having a fairy godmother, she had a magical fish. And she wished upon this fish who then gave her clothes, and she went to the fair, but she left behind a feather from her coat and was eventually caught out. But then her stepmother and half-sister, even though they tried to punish her, were then killed in a rock slide. And everyone lived happily ever after. So you can see different elements of the Cinderella that we know now. Like, one has a ball, one doesn't, one has a shoe, one doesn't. But they do share similarities, but like they couldn't have informed each other at all, like originally. It's interesting.
Yeah, it just means that there must be something, some fundamental thing that all humans, or like many different kinds of humans, find compelling in a story.
Well, I guess in that one it would be the like leaving something of yourself behind, and people attributing worth or value or some kind of spirit to an item of clothing. And I can definitely see that be, you know, inherent human thing to do, and then building a tale out of that.
I just love the idea of finding a slipper and being like, hot.
I know. Cinderella itself is very foot fetishy, isn't it? It's interesting.
So as you kind of mentioned about there being many, many kind of darker elements to fairy tales that especially children maybe don't know about, you know, for example, The Little Mermaid dying at the end, which when I found out about that as a child, I was shook.
Broken.
Like, I was and I was like grimly fascinated by that in a way that like you know, I guess that is maybe a relatable thing for many children, that when you're allowed to like engage with something that is dark or like a subvert, you know, what is appears to you as a subversion of something that you thought was like pure and good and happy, that's very fascinating. But what is your kind of your favorite like deviation from a fairy tale that kind of we have experienced in the course of its telling and retelling?
Well, I think that the change that really opened up the world of fairy tales for me was a Roald Dahl tale from Revolting Rhymes. Yes, Roald Dahl. The more we look at Roald Dahl, the more problematic he gets. But it's true that it was his book that made me think, wait, you can play with fairy tales, you can do things to them. And it's the Red Riding Hood one. And I used to know it off by heart, which I don't anymore. Well, the Three Little Pigs version, where the three little pigs call Red Riding Hood because they're really stressed because there's a wolf outside their door. And I just love this intertextuality of like, oh my God, you can mash fairy tales together. You can bring characters together. So the little pig calls Red Riding Hood and she says, oh my dear, you know, I'm just drying my hair, but I'll be right there. And she turns up and she's got a gun and I'm like, what is this? And she's got a gun and it says her eyelid gives a flicker, she whipped a pistol from her knickers. And I was like, yes, this is amazing. So then she kills the wolf, but then because she's awful, she also kills the pig. And then she has a wolfskin coat and a pigskin traveling case, and I was just fascinated by that. And then I started thinking about, you know, fairy tales of old, and then went through the obligatory Angela Carter phase, Jeanette Winterson, how can we use psychological elements to kind of tell stories using fairy tales? But there are so many, I suppose, different changes to fairy tales. So my favourite one, I'm not sure, which I know is a very boring answer. For anyone who's listening, I do have a series of videos on my YouTube channel where I do a deep dive into the history of each particular fairy tale. A particular factoid that I like is that Louis XIV was commissioning stories for like really raunchy parties that he was having, and one of them ended up being Little Red Riding Hood, and it was supposed to be like really sexy. It wasn't really a moral tale at that point. You know, I think a lot of people interpret it as don't walk off the path, don't go off with strangers because something bad will happen. You can definitely read it like that, and some of them were definitely supposed to be read like that, but it was supposed to be really sexy when it was first written, because these were essentially orgies that people were attending with food. I mean, sounds great. So it was a metaphor that everyone understood, that meeting the wolf was losing your virginity. That was the metaphor. So it was that she was going to bed with the wolf and she was very happy about it. In fact, in one of the early versions, she does like a striptease for him. So that's fun, because I wasn't taught that when I learned about Red Riding Hood. It was just don't talk to strangers, which I feel is a very, you know, sadly modified version that it loses some of its spark.
So I think our next two questions we've kind of covered, thinking about modern retellings and your favourites. But I'd love to go back to something that you mentioned earlier about disability representation in fairy tales. Can we like deep dive a little bit more into what you meant by that?
Because if we cannot deep dive with you, who can we deep dive it with?
Let's do it. Guys, can we repeat that question? I forgot to put a do not disturb on my phone and my husband just tried to call me, so your audio cut out for a second.
Oh, no worries.
Apologies.
Okay, so next, earlier on we very briefly touched upon disability representation in fairy tales. And I was just wondering if we could go back to that and do a little deep dive into what you mean by that.
Okay, well, in old stories, of which obviously fairy tales fall into that category, there's a lot of representation of disability as a metaphor or as a teaching moment. Disability as a marker for villainy goes back to Greek theatre, when there was a belief that you could show someone's like personal attributes on the outside. So if people were playing multiple parts in a play, they would wear wooden masks and they would mark the villain with a certain kind of marker, very vague, but a certain marker so that people watching would go, oh, that's the bad guy, okay. And then that just continued, and then it ties up in religious messages of redemption and of sin. And you can understand it in some respects, I'm not excusing it at all, but when we don't understand something, as humans, we make up stories for it. That's what a lot of fairy tales are. A lot of them are origin stories, or, you know, how the leopard got his spots, or how the sun and the moon came to be. And when some of the stories were about disability and why people were born with certain conditions, because, you know, knowledge of science just was non-existent. So in that respect, I understand. So there are a lot of fairy tales warning people about, you know, behaving correctly and being good so that you don't end up being punished by God, essentially, in a bodily kind of way. And this factors into Victorian fairy tales quite a lot, because this was when discussions of evolution had really ramped up and there was a lot of fascination with science and so many discussions of, you know, thinking about bodies in all their many forms and why bodies behaved in certain ways. So storytellers were trying to include science in the stories that they were telling in order to be fashionable, because it was fashionable to have science in your stories. So there are some amazing fairy tales that came about where fairies could help children calculate chemical like equations and balance them by, you know, having hydrogen on one of their wings and then having, you know, oxygen on the other, and put those together and what do you get? It's really odd. And then they would try and think about the origin of fairies in a scientific way. So if you looked at entomology, which is the study of insects, on some charts they would have fairies listed as an insect that hadn't been discovered yet, you know, because when they first discovered dinosaur bones they thought, oh, they're dragons, which you can completely see, or they're giants or something. You know, they were thinking, oh my goodness, if there are all these things that we've made up, what if they're true? How do we bring these things together? So maybe fairies are real. And then there were lots of stories about fairies, you know, doing things out of sight that you couldn't see. And there's that fairy tale about the elves and the shoemaker, you know, they make the shoes at night when you can't see them. So there was a story about fairies who got rid of germs when people started to understand germs. Like, if we can't see fairies and we can't see germs, then maybe fairies are good things that can get rid of germs. So marketing companies then latched onto this storytelling and they invented something called fairy soap and sold it to people. And it's why we still have fairy washing up liquid, because that's what fairy soap became. It was a brand. These fairies can clean your kitchen. So alongside that, which is really cool, there were stories that people like P.T. Barnum were coming up with, and freak show owners who were trying to mix science with disability to come up with stories to sell to people and make them come and see their show. So people like P.T. Barnum would often name people in their show as after animals, so the lion woman or the tiger man, and they would say, well, this person is half animal, half human, therefore they are proof of evolution. This is the fairy story I'm going to come up with about them. They're fascinating, like, come and see them. And as much as I, as a disabled person, would love to be called some kind of mythical creature, it sounds very seductive. It's obviously like really crass and exploitative and not cool at all. So I have a condition called ectrodactyly, which used to be called lobster claw syndrome, because it effectively can look like you have lobster claws for hands if you didn't have surgery, which you wouldn't have had in the Victorian times. So I would have been the lobster girl if I was in a circus. So this is all to say that bodily transformation has been tied up in fairy tales in a variety of ways. Some of them have tried to be scientific explanations, and some of them have been tied up in religious messages. We can look at something like Beauty and the Beast, which is thought to have been inspired by a real-life person called Petrus Gonsalves, who had a condition called hypertrichosis, which is where hair grows all over your body. And he was born in the 1500s in Tenerife, sold into the courts, and was moved across Europe, and various people, in inverted commas, owned him. And then a monarch decided it would be really hilarious to marry him off to someone that she didn't particularly like, someone called Lady Catherine. So they set up this marriage where they didn't get to meet in advance, and they thought it would be really funny. But then joke was on them, because it turned out that Petrus and Lady Catherine loved each other very much, and they had 7 children. So this was a story that was known very much in the courts, and was told multiple times. There are lots of animal bridegroom stories that exist in fairy tales. Some of those are inspired by things such as arranged marriage, as a kind of warning, you know, if you haven't met someone, what are they going to be like? But it is thought that Petrus in particular inspired the story of Beauty and the Beast, which was written down a couple of hundred years later. It was originally a novel. But obviously in Beauty and the Beast, Adam, as he's called in Disney, though he was never called that in the film, they panicked afterwards. I don't know if you guys know that. Like they didn't call him anything in the film. And then they, when it came to making merch, they were like, oh my God, what's he called? We have to call him something. We call him Adam. We definitely called him that in the film. Just stick the name on the box. No one will know. So in the original tale and then in subsequent versions, Adam was punished for being, in inverted commas, a bad person and was turned from a beautiful man into a beast. And it was only if someone could love him that he would be turned back into his original form. But that's a metaphor, and it was based on a real-life person called Petrus. And no matter how good Petrus was, he wasn't going to not have hypertrichosis, and he didn't have it because he'd been bad in the first place. So there's this weird metaphor that still exists in a lot of stories, not just fairy tales, but loads of media that we consume where the bad guy has a disfigurement in order to tell the reader or the viewer in a very lazy way that they shouldn't be trusted. Think of horror movies, James Bond villains, comic book villains. There are some exceptions to the rule, but they don't break the rule yet. And that's something that I definitely wanted to subvert when I was writing these fairy tales. So no one has anything happen to them because of the way that they look. The word beautiful is only used once. And when that word is used, it's about a man. And we've got an Inuit myth in here, which celebrates a princess whose fingers are cut off. I mean, obviously, I would like that. I have missing fingers myself. And I also included a story with a deaf man. And then also we've got a princess who has alopecia, which I also have. And there are fairy tales that contain alopecia. But again, when I was researching it, it was always the goal that she would get her hair back. And that would be her reward if she was a good person. So I wanted to write a fairy tale where she actually wasn't fussed about getting her hair back. And all of these princes wanted to get it back for her because they thought it would make her more beautiful. But she just, you know, wants to read books and have a good time with her girlfriend. So that's what she ends up doing. And she has a great time. So that's, yeah, that was a long answer to your question. You're very welcome.
No, thank you.
Because, like, you know, you truly are, you know, we are all clever ladies here, but I just feel like it's so pleasurable to be talking to someone who is like a true expert in an interesting field. So please, you know, we love a long answer, especially when it's someone very knowledgeable talking knowledgeably about something that's so interesting.
Thank you. I just never want to be that guy in the audience, you know, at book events where, does anyone have any questions? And they stand up and they just start telling you about a book that they've started writing in their basement, and it has no relevance to anything that anyone else is ever saying. And it's just,
but Jen, you are the event. You're the event.
Yeah. You're the event. Okay.
You are what we're here for. Do you find that people are more kind of receptive, like, you know, over the time that you have been writing about, talking about, thinking about, you know, especially things like kind of facial disfigurement as a shorthand for badness in a character, like, have you found that people have become more interested in that and more receptive in that as time has gone by? Or do you get kind of pushback when you're talking about, you know, the James Bond villain, for example?
I mean, if anyone has opinions about James Bond, oh, the men, they appear, they will find you. They have some kind of device, some kind of radar, and they find you. It's interesting. I think it varies. Like, sometimes I can feel complacent and think, oh, we're getting somewhere, and then there'll just be something really horrible that will happen. And I'm just, you know, that moment when you step out your bubble and you remember how lots of people regard a subject, and you think, oh wait, we've still got so much work to do. I think it's hard to answer concisely. I mean, I find it hard to answer anything concisely, let's be honest. But I think in some aspects things are moving forward. I now, as part of my job, talk to publishers about representation of disfigurement and disability, you know, what books we platform, who we platform, why, whilst also discussing sensitivity reading, which I think can be a good tool. And I have worked as a sensitivity reader on a couple of books where disability has been a topic that authors and publishers have wanted to make sure they've got right. But I also worry that promoting sensitivity reading can be used as a means for publishers to ignore disabled voices and think that they can just fix narratives by using disabled people later. And that's not something that I want to advocate for at all. I want us to really focus on highlighting disabled voices and own voices stories when the story itself in particular is about disability. And I am here for incidental representation of disability in stories that other people are writing if they've got a wide range of characters, because I think it's important to reflect life. But it is frustrating when a lot of big hitting books, especially for kids, that focus a disabled character are written by non-disabled writers. And I think in essence it's because non-disabled people are more comfortable talking about disability with non-disabled people. I think they're worried about saying the wrong thing. I think similar things happen with race and with queerness. And on a base level, I can understand, but it's something that I don't have much sympathy for, because obviously me, I feel so much more uncomfortable than they do in a situation where I'm trying to talk about representation and basically convince people that disabled people should be valued as humans. Like, that's a much more awkward conversation for me to have. So I think it's good if we can all acknowledge that some of these discussions make us feel awkward, and that's okay, and we need to move past that and get on with it. So I have made videos talking about the representation of disfigurement and disability. A few years ago I was asked to go on a TV show called Too Ugly for Love, which was just a horrendous experience. I didn't go on the TV show, but it's this kind of marketing, publicity, media that really grates me, because I think that we can think we've moved away from things like freak shows, but I think they just exist in different forms. Mm-hmm. And TV shows like Too Ugly for Love or The Undateables, they platform disabled people, but it's to make a non-disabled audience feel good about themselves. And this company had reached out to me because they realized that they were just looking on the hunt for disabled people. And messaged me and hadn't looked at my profile at all. If they had, not that it's the relevant thing, they would have seen that I was married. Their assumption was I must not be, and I must be miserable and single because I look different. And obviously that's just, that's not true. So things like that can get in the bin. I think they can get in the bin. And then the more nuanced things, you know, talking about the representation in wider media, like James Bond, yes, I feel like we're having these conversations. I find it really emotionally exhausting to have them whenever those things come around. They seems to be once a year. This year it was James Bond. Last year it was The Witches, when Warner Brothers brought out a new version of it, where the witches in this had not only alopecia and missing toes, but also ectrodactyly, so missing fingers. And I think this just needs to be more thought, because it wasn't just the film. They took the witch hunt out of the film. They had a marketing campaign called hashtag witches are real, in which they released a video encouraging children to point out women who look different, who didn't have hair, who had missing fingers, because they're witches. And I was like, sorry, did anyone sit down and think about this critically? Because I guarantee if you did, this would have been flagged. It's not okay. I mean, they apologized for it, but like, it's just not something that people are thinking about enough. Let's think about it.
The thing about that as well is knowing how many people go through the that process. Do you know what I mean? Like, that, how many sets of hands would have gone through the campaign before it was approved? How did that conversation not come up immediately?
Exactly. And I think, you know, limb difference, okay, maybe is less common than something like alopecia, but also so many women and men go through chemo. Like, we know, I just feel like it gets to the point where I'm like, surely people know of people. Like, we're not like unicorns. Like, we exist. Hello. Still holding out for unicorns existing, but I definitely exist. I can say that with some certainty. Yes. So I think we are moving forward, but I do think that that also means the backlash is bigger in some cases, because it's not a conversation people want to hear. They think that, you know, you can't say anything these days, you know, oh, can't my James Bond villain just have disfigurements? And the latest one, there are three villains. They all have facial disfigurements. But the argument is no longer, does media impact people's perception of visual difference? That's been proven time and time again. The argument is, how are we going to move forward and change? So if we could all get to that point, instead of the arguing about whether or not, you know, some middle-aged white guys allowed to enjoy James Bond in peace without the PC police being there, then that would be great. Something that is like stressful to think about, and is just also that concept of being a good disabled person. You know, I think you have the gut reaction of wanting to appease and be nice about things, and I try and do that, and I just worry, like, talking like this, for instance, I know there are going to be, well, maybe not on this podcast, but in general, if I said this, people think, oh my god, she's a bit of a killjoy, she's a bit boring, but it does impact, you know, our lives, so it is something to critically think about.
It matters, of course it matters. And I feel like, certainly in the spirit of looking forward and whether or not change is happening, I'd love to know what your perspective is on why fairy tales are still something that attracts us as readers, and why fairy tales are a good vehicle for this change.
I think, as I mentioned before, like when you change something about fairy tales, say if you have two princesses who end up together, or you have someone with a disability who is the hero, it's dismantling all the stories that you've heard before. Well, maybe not dismantling them, but shining a light on those stories and making you realize, oh wait, I haven't heard this before. Like, why haven't I heard it before? Fairy tales are such an ingrained part of our culture. They're something that we understand from a young age because they're the earliest kind of stories that we're introduced to. It's like a hereditary thing, really. It's kind of beautiful. So I think we all have this nostalgic feel of fairy tales, and that can be really a powerful thing to tap into. If you can reach someone's, like, I don't know, innate memories of storytelling and be like, can I play with those a little bit and expand them and show you new ways of talking about life, essentially, then that can have a knock-on effect on how people view storytelling as a whole, for instance. And then obviously outside of stories and how they see people in real life. I mean, there is that phrase, you've got to see it to be it, which I think can be a bit of a reductive thing, but there is truth to it, that stories can be either windows or mirrors. So not necessarily fairy tales, well, fairy tales too, but stories in general. If, for instance, there is good representation of a disabled character in a story, that can be a mirror to disabled people because they can see themselves. But it could also be a story that is a window which shows a disabled person like out into the world and presents something fantastical and wonderful and otherworldly. And both of those representations are important. And that is why a disability shouldn't be used as just a teaching device. You know, I think we see it often in children's books in particular, how to treat disabled people like well. So it would be like a character who's not disabled learns to accept a disabled person or learn something about themselves. That's not just what stories are for, because disabled people also exist and we also need the stories. So I think if we can change the stories that we're telling, including fairy tales, to have incidental representation of queerness, disability, race, everything, then it has an impact on all the other stories that we then consume.
Cool.
Yeah.
So, sorry, I just had to unmute myself because I've been having a little cough.
I wondered where you are. I was like, waiting for you to come in.
Yeah, I was like, oh no, I have to unmute myself two places. That's too much for my brain. So, as we know, Christmas is very much on the horizon. Mm-hmm. And if you were going to give The Sister Who Ate Her Brothers as a Christmas gift, whomst would you give it to?
Can I say everyone? No, that's a compromise.
Yes,
everyone. Well, it is primarily for 8 to 13-year-olds, but also for any adults who love a gruesome tale or two. You could give it to someone who was younger than 8. It depends on the child. So, for instance, when I'd written it, I did do a read through with my niece and nephew who are 8 and 5, and I was going to read through with my nephew, but obviously my niece was like, how dare you? I mean, I need to be in on this. He can't have something that I can't have. So I had to read it to her too. And she is a little monster herself. So she was fine with the grit and the gore. In fact, I wanted to have their quotes because this is obviously a COVID book, we didn't have proofs to send out to people, so we didn't have any author quotes when it first came out. But I did have quotes from my niece and nephew, and their quotes were gross and disgusting. And I was like, that's great. Like, let's put those quotes on the front. So yeah, I think you can go younger. If your child is into scary stuff, that's fine.
If your child's a little ghoul. Yeah,
that would be my recommendation.
Relatable.
Oh, sorry, pals. Did I cut out a second there?
Yeah, no, it's fine. Yes, I'm here. You're good. Okay, and then one more question. So this, I guess this, because I wrote these questions for our Halloween-themed interview, which now this is, I guess, more of a Christmassy-themed. But I was going to ask if you have any spooky reading recommendations. So maybe instead...
Christmas, spooky for all year. Yeah.
I want all year round spook. And also I'm very interested in Jen's taste. So, you know, I'm in favour of us keeping that question exactly as it is.
Okay. It has been gavel down. It's been spoken. Any spooky book recommendations for us, please?
As you mentioned, Christmas is coming up. So there is Spooky Christmas. The British Library have their cozy crime books, which I really like, but they also have this spooky series, and some of those are spooky Christmas stories. So I actually own one of those, which I haven't read yet, but I plan to read this year. But spooky recommendations in general. I'm kind of into unsettling at the moment. I recently read Mrs. March, which I think you read recently, Alice, too. Is that right?
Yes, I
really like to read that.
It's so good. It's a play on Jane Eyre a little bit, but also is like Stepford Wives type. I don't know. It reminded me a lot of Death in Her Hands by Tessa Mosveig, because it's a woman who isn't sure if a crime has been committed and she's trying to investigate it. But it's just brilliant because you don't know whether to trust her or not. And it feels like she's being gaslighted by her husband, but then maybe not. I don't know. Anyway, love that. That was fantastic. And I've been delving into Patricia Highsmith, because she is the queen. She is the queen. Absolutely. I recently learned, did you know, that she carried snails around in her handbag wherever she went?
I did know that, yeah.
I just love that. It's so great. So I recently... I recently read The Talented Miss Ripley, because I'd never read it before, which is a crime, an absolute crime, and loved it. And I know that they're turning that into a TV show, a new one next year with Andrew Scott as Ripley, which I think will be great.
I'm a fan of the Anthony Minghella film. I think that film is absolutely exceptional.
So I only watched it for the first time the other day, and I've never read The Talented Mr. Ripley, so I feel like
the film is very faithful. So if you've seen the film, I would say you can get away with not reading the book, but reading any Patricia Highsmith is such a pleasurable experience, if you ask me.
Such a pleasurable experience.
She's such a safe pair of hands.
Yes, absolutely. And I love like the queerness that she weaves into her stories. Obviously it's very overt in Carol, but it's still there in Ripley too. And even in Deep Water, which I also read recently, where a husband and wife are in this loveless marriage and the wife is openly having affairs and bringing her boyfriend dinner parties to see what her husband will do. So he decides he's going to make up the fact that he killed one of her previous boyfriends to try and deter people, but then it just escalates into something weird. But it does like seem, because he says at one point that he would quite like her to bring back a different kind of man, and maybe they could have a relationship together. So there is this like discussion of sexuality going on in the background, but primarily it's about murder, which is, you know, always a fun time. But they're making that into a film. They're making that into a film next year too, with Ben Affleck as Vic. I'm not sure how I feel about that, but I will definitely watch it. So.
Cool. And then I guess our final question is just one more. I wanted to know if you're working on anything new.
I think, is that the question every writer like hates? Like, I'm just like, I have a panic when it, and it's fine. Like, it's fine because it's like a question, obviously, I have an answer for, but I like panic whenever I hear that. I'm like, wait, am I? What should I be doing? Oh my goodness. So I am planning another fairy tale book, which will look at more of the, it will be for kids in the same vein as this, but it will encompass more on the history of fairy tales along with retellings. So that's something I'm working on. And then I am also doing a non-fiction book on fairy tales and disability, but I feel like that one is probably going to be evolving for a while. I feel like it's something that's going to need a few years, and because part of it is, God, I hate saying this, like part of it is memoir, which I feel like makes you sound like an absolute twat, but it is. So I feel like it needs a few years longer for some kind of specific, for some of the content in there. So that's something that is going on in the background. And then I'm also working on a new poetry collection as well, which is slowly coming together. That's what I'm doing.
That's so exciting.
I love that for future us.
Yes, yes. Lucky you who doesn't have to write it. You just get to read it. I hate you.
The best bit. Well, thank you so, so much for joining us. You are literally such a dreamy guest because you are so interesting and you're good at talking. And yeah, I think I can speak for both of us when I say that we have loved having you on.
Thank you. You're very lovely. I love you both. Thank you. And also, as we said before we started recording, so grateful that we were recording today when National Book Token's Hidden Book Game has just come out. And I know that Alice is dying to get back to it. So I feel like really honoured that you are talking to me. Thank you.
Imagine
the definition
though,
of prime time.
If I sent you an email at 5 to 11, Jen, so sorry, have to reschedule again. I know you know, Hidden Book Game. Yeah, no worries.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And
thank you for having me.
Your book is out now in the UK.
And it is out now in the UK.
Soon and in the US, if we have any Americans listening. Mm-hmm. So The Sister Who Ate Her Brothers by you, Jen Campbell, is out
by
now.
By me. And it's illustrated by Adam D'Souza, who has done some wonderful creepy illustrations inside. And I should also say, it has a ribbon bookmark, which I think is the main sell. The main sell, a ribbon bookmark.
Extremely bougie.
Mm,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Thank you. Thanks, bye.